It's 6 o'clock on Monday, the 29th of March. Good morning. This is Today with Justin Webb and John Humphreys.
The headlines this morning, there are reports of two explosions in the last few hours on the Moscow underground. It's believed more than 20 people have died. The Conservatives are to announce that they're going to reduce a planned future rise in national insurance contributions. The resignation of one of the government's drugs advisers has thrown doubts on whether efforts to ban methadone can immediately be put into effect. And also in today's programme, a call for community and the common good to get a better showing in our political debate. And is digital radio still the future? The BBC News is read by Neil Sleat.
The Conservatives are promising a tax cut for millions of lower and middle-income earners if they win the general election. The Shadow Chancellor, George Osborne, will announce today that a planned 1% rise in national insurance next year wouldn't go ahead for most people and employers. Labour has accused Mr. Osborne of making promises he can't afford. Our political editor Nick Robinson reports.
A tax cut for 7 out of 10 working people, a tax cut for businesses too, and a start to cutting the deficit. Today, the Conservatives will claim to be able to do all of that. The Shadow Chancellor, George Osborne, will pledge to block not all, but a part of what he's dubbed a tax on jobs and a tax on the middle classes. The planned 1% increase in national insurance contributions due to hit both employers and employees in a year's time. To pay for this and an immediate cut to the budget deficit, he'll outline proposals to cut government spending plans this financial year, cancelling some projects whilst pledging to reduce waste and cut the cost of procurement. The Tories' opponents are sure to respond by claiming that the opposition's sums simply don't add up.
The government is to outline proposals to expand the financial services offered by the post office. The ideas include a new account to help people on low incomes manage their household budgets and a new mortgage aimed at first-time buyers. The business minister, Pei McFadden, said the plans were a major step towards making the post office a sustainable neighbourhood banking service. At least 25 people have been killed in an explosion on the metro system in Moscow. The blast happened at the central Lubyanka station in the morning rush hour. The Interfax news agency says it was caused by a suicide bomber. And within the past few minutes, there have been reports of an explosion at another station. The Commons Treasury Committee has criticised the government's plans to reform Britain's banking system, saying it was wrong to rule out radical change. The MPs on the committee have urged ministers to ensure that taxpayers don't have to pick up the bill for future bailouts. Here's our business editor, Robert Peston.
The Treasury Select Committee isn't saying that the big banks must be broken up, but it is saying that it was wrong of the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, to rule out the option of forcing radical structural reforms on the banks. In that sense, the committee's report will be seen as embarrassing for Labour and more supportive of the Tories and the Lib Dems, both of which are reasonably sympathetic to the idea of breaking up the banks into narrow banks that would look after our savings and be protected in an explicit way by the state, and more speculative banks that could be allowed to fail.
A government drugs advisor has resigned, throwing into disarray plans to announce a ban on methadone. Dr. Polly Taylor says she lacks confidence in the way ministers will treat advice from the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs. The Home Secretary, Alan Johnson, had been expected to announce a ban on methadone today. Our Home Editor, Mark Easton, reports.
Government ministers have made no secret of their determination to act on methadone following a series of deaths in which the victim is said to have taken the stimulant. Today, the Advisory Council are due to tell the Home Secretary how dangerous they think methadone is ahead of a likely ban. But it's argued the resignation of the vet on the council means the committee is now not properly constituted and won't be able to issue advice to ministers. Dr. Polly Taylor has written to the Home Secretary saying she's resigning because a code of practice introduced after the controversial sacking of the former chairman, Professor David Nutt, won't, she says, stop advice being subjected to a desire to please ministers or the mood of the day's press. The Home Office has yet to comment.
12 teenagers are due to appear in court charged with the murder of a 15-year-old boy who was stabbed at one of London's busiest railway stations. Sofyan Belamouadin died after being attacked at Victoria Station during the rush hour on Thursday night. Police say 7 teenagers have been released on bail after being questioned. New rules on MPs' expenses will be set out today. The Independent Parliamentary Standards Authority has been studying a number of proposals, but it's unclear what conclusions have been reached. Our political correspondent Carol Walker has more details.
The head of the new independent body, Sir Ian Kennedy, has said he wants a clean break with the past. More than 2,500 people, including many MPs, responded to the five-week consultation on the new rules, which are due to come into force on the first day of the new parliament. The rules on expenses have already been tightened since the expenses scandal, but MPs will be told today they'll have to comply with a new regime covering not just their second home's allowance, but travel and office costs and whether they can employ family members in future.
The traditional start to the cricket season in England is being staged at a new venue, Abu Dhabi. The four-day match between the MCC and the county champions Durham will be in stark contrast to the conditions at Lord's. Temperatures at the ground are expected to reach 40 Celsius, and the game will be played partly under floodlights using a pink ball.
Thank you, John. 7 minutes past six. The last pope to resign was Gregory in 1415. Pope Benedict has been making it clear over the weekend that there is no chance at all that he will follow suit. Our correspondent in Rome is Duncan Kennedy. And Duncan, he didn't speak directly, did he, about the paedophile scandal, but it was pretty clear what he was talking about.
Yes, I mean, a concerted but coded effort to stand up for himself, really, speaking about not allowing oneself to be intimidated by the petty gossip of dominant opinion. So clearly the Pope's way of going about saying enough is enough after the days and days of barrage of attacks by the media about his handling of the Father Lawrence Murphy case in Milwaukee in Wisconsin. This was the Pope turning round using the Palm Sunday service as a way of saying, look, this is unfair, this is unjustified, me of all people should not be subject to this kind of criticism, and here we are, part of the effort by the Catholic Church to fight back against those attacks.
And insofar as we can know it, what is the view, the wider view in the corridors of the Vatican about the strategy from that?
Well, I think there's a great sense of injustice against the Pope, and I think they will want to take the fight to it's what they call its critics, those people trying to smear it, as it was put last week. Not least because they think Pope Benedict, above all else, is one of those who's taken the fight against the abusers in the first place. They say he has a proven track record of fighting abuse wherever he saw it. He's the man who introduced the one strike and you're out policy in the United States. He's the one who instigated discipline against priests without church courts convening. He's the one who instigated this fast-track discipline method all round. He's the one who's taken the fight against abuse to these priests, so he should be the last one to be criticised. So I think this is part of their concerted efforts. We had Archbishop Vincent Nichols speaking yesterday, saying there's no reason for the Pope to resign. We had Vatican Radio saying, yes, we must look after the interests of victims, but we also need to regain the moral credibility of the Church and take the fight, because we believe we have a good message to our enemies, as they put it, to those people who are attacking us, we think, unjustifiably.
Duncan Kennedy in Rome, thank you.
6:10 in Thailand, the Prime Minister is going to talk to protesters who are threatening to bring down the government. Rachel Harvey is our correspondent in Bangkok. Who are these people, Rachel?
They are a loose coalition of left-wing pro-democracy activists and supporters of the exiled Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawat. The government has until now painted them as purely a proxy for Mr. Thaksin. But I think the fact that the Prime Minister is now prepared to sit down across the table from some of these protest leaders, it really shows that the movement has developed beyond Mr. Thaksin himself, and that the government now recognises that after 2 weeks of mass anti-government demonstrations, they have to sit down and talk. They have to acknowledge that this movement is now a political force to be reckoned with.
It has a lot of popular support.
It does have quite a lot of popular support. There have been 2 weeks of these very noisy, very colourful protests, which have peaked at the weekends when people obviously are not working and can join the protests, but tens of thousands of people on a regular basis taking to the streets. The support base is largely in the rural north and northeast, but I've certainly seen a lot of Bangkokians, more sort of working class, lower middle class, also coming out to join the protests. So it has spread. There is a big body of support in favour of what the Red Shirts, as they're known, the anti-government protesters are calling for, which is fresh elections. But so far, the Prime Minister has resisted that demand.
But at least the troops aren't on the streets.
Well, the troops are on the streets, but only in their view to maintain security under special security legislation, and they've been very low profile and non-confrontational. In fact, on Saturday, the protesters went deliberately to some military checkpoints to try and persuade the army to stand down, and the army did. In effect, they relocated rather than confront the protesters. So they're not on the streets in the sense of another military coup, but they are very much there in the background.
Many thanks, Rachel.
11 minutes past six. National insurance is a subject on the front pages of quite a few of the papers. The Tories are putting tax cuts at the heart of the election battle, says The Guardian. The Conservatives will today attempt to reinvigorate their general election campaign by pledging to make tax cuts the centrepiece, and those tax cuts focusing on national insurance. A promise revealed in the Telegraph as well to block next year's rises in national insurance, allowing the Conservatives to fight the general election on a platform of lower taxes. The Telegraph saying that Labour has tried to suggest that Tory plans would be funded by increasing VAT after the election, but Conservative sources are insisting their plan would not be funded by tax rises. The Times are not entirely convinced. The Times' deputy business editor, Ian King, saying, in pledging to unwind an NI rise yet to be introduced, George Osborne is giving voters back something many of them probably had no idea they were about to lose.
Exclusive on the front page of The Guardian. So it says the government is going to unveil radical proposals that would give football fans first option to buy their clubs when they're put up for sale and require clubs to hand over a stake of up to 25% to supporters group. Apparently this is going to be in the Labour manifesto with a promise of action in the first year of a new government.
The Independent has a very arresting photograph on the front page, a kind of photo taken up the nostrils of a horse. And the headline reads, Tally Ho, which doesn't tell you a lot till you read the strap underneath it. Fox hunting Barber Cavalry prepares to ride to the rescue of the Conservatives in key marginal seats. Hundreds of Hunt supporters, the Independent says, are under orders to ride into action in key marginal seats within hours of a general election being called, in the knowledge that David Cameron will allow a return to hunting with dogs if he gets into Downing Street.
Front page of the Mail says Britain has become a nation of pill poppers who will turn to tablets to cure every ill. This, according to the latest figures, we each pick up more than 16 prescriptions a year on average. That's twice as many as 20 years ago, apparently, and that is in spite of the fact that people, says the Mail, are living longer and healthier lives than ever before. I suppose it could be because of it as well, really, couldn't it? Yeah. It's a possibility.
And finally, another secret weapon unveiled in the coming election battle. The Daily Mirror also claiming an exclusive. Labour's secret weapon is going to be Tony Blair. He'll launch a devastating pre-election campaign ambush on David Cameron, the Mirror says. Labour strategist telling the Mirror, Blair is a brilliant performer on the campaign trail. His intervention will expose Mr. Cameron and his cronies as political lightweights.
Pew in the Mail cartoon, nice one. Bloke adjusting his clock in the living room, his wife looking on slightly puzzled, and he says to her, I'm trying to move the clock forward to after the elections. And so say all
of us. Indeed, it is 6:15, just a spot before. Should the banks be broken up to stop them becoming too big to fail? Adam Shaw will address that subject now, and plenty of others. Good morning.
And plenty of others. Good morning to you, Justin. A key parliamentary report, which is published today, says the government should consider breaking up the banks. It says the government must embrace radical reform and shouldn't dismiss US plans to split the bank's speculative trading activities, the risky bits, away from the less risky bits, the retail banking, the stuff that runs our bank accounts. The House of Commons Treasury Select Committee came to that conclusion after examining ways of making sure the taxpayer isn't left footing the bill for future banking crises. Well, John McFall is the chairman of the Treasury Select Committee and joins us on the line now. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
I notice you don't importantly say banks should be split up, just that the government should consider that option. Why did you hesitate in making that firm suggestion? Why didn't you come off the fence?
Well, as we say, as we stand at the moment, the taxpayer's still on the hook and we tolerate the present system at our peril. It's a very complex system. It's going to take years to change. And we're saying that radical reform is needed, structural change is essential, and we should not rule out anything. It I think, is short-sighted to rule something out, and therefore to look at narrow banking is important. We have said that narrow banking should be looked at, and perhaps the issue of making international banks subsidiaries. However, if we have too narrow banking, then the risk can be transferred to the shadow banking sector. So we have to take our time to change the financial architecture.
I mean, you're firm in your view that radical reform of some kind is actually needed. I mean, having spent a very long time looking at this and indeed been at the centre of the sort of regulatory overview of the crisis we've gone through, what is your personal view? Do you feel it would be a good thing to split these banks into two?
Well, actually, we've got the situation at the moment where we have the universal banks, and we have had a number of advocates coming before us for the universal banks, and they're saying that it does supply more credit and it is a better system. But the core issue for me is, if there's a problem with the universal bank, then the organisers of that go to the Chancellor of the Exchequer of that country and say, you have a problem here in your country as a result of this. However, you do also have a problem in New York, you do have a problem in Tokyo, you do have a problem elsewhere. So the issue of the universal bank means that the risk can spread. How do we try and contain that risk so that we get a bank going to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, say, and saying, this is a subsidiary in this country, this is where your problem is, and this is only where your problem is. As long as we have universal banks, then we do have that recipe for that instability and for the taxpayer still to be on the hook for billions and billions of pounds. We must change this system so that we get the risk transferred to the financial sector, and that a big financial institution in difficulties can then go under smoothly. That's the benefit, and that's the end of it.
I understand the problem, and you explain it well. What I don't understand is if you've come to a view of what should be done. I mean, it's easy to say there is a problem, less easy to say what the solution is. Is it right that you yourself haven't come to a solution?
Well, actually, we do say about living wills, we're very, very clear on living wills, and we're asking the FSA and the banks to work together on that so that we get these living wills. That will give an examination of companies and what they are all about, and it will inflict the losses on all creditors and bondholders as a result of that. So living wills is a big okay. start, and we want that to take place, and to take place quickly.
The point that you make, that people should consider splitting the risky part of banks up from the less risky bit, the point of that is that the government could, if it went under, could wash its hands, effectively, of the major investment bank going bust. That's the point of that sort of strategy. If that was implemented, do you think that if a major investment bank got into trouble, a government could practically step aside and let it go? Would it not have a major effect on the economy, and it would have to step in and bail it out anyway?
Exactly. But what we are seeing is that financial crisis will always occur. In fact, on the front page of our report, we have a bunch of tulips. They're for a very good reason. Reform may increase the time between one crisis and the next and reduce the severity of the crisis, but it would be irrationally optimistic to expect that any intervention could reduce the chance of a crisis to zero. And really what we're looking for, if I could put it in simple language, we're looking for, if risk happens, a good fire brigade, so that that fire brigade comes along, puts the fire out in one room of the house, but doesn't let the house burn down, as almost happened this time.
Okay, John McFall, many thanks. Let's move on to the markets. Last week on Wall Street, the Dow Jones ended up 108 points, about 1% higher, not a bad week. 10,850 here at home. The FTSE 100 ended the week up 50 points, more or less 1% up as well. 5,703 in Tokyo. The new trading week's already begun, and the Nikkei's moving the opposite direction in its last session. It's down 33 points. It closed just a few moments ago at 10,963. The pound's up 0.4 cents against the dollar at $1.49. It's down 0.1 cents against euro at €1.11, which makes a euro, well, just a tiny, tiny bit over 90 pence. Well, our market's guest this morning is Rob Bergman from the investment managers Brewin Dolphin. Good morning.
Morning, Adam.
News we're seeing in lots of the papers, China's largest private sector automaker, Geely, is buying Volvo. We think of it as Swedish, but it's actually already owned by Ford of America. Is this a big game changer, as they say, for the auto market, that we have a Chinese brand owning one of these very famous marks?
Well, the pressures on consolidation in the car market have been pretty intense. Geely, a name that's probably not that well known to people, it has a controlling stake in Manganese Bronze, which makes the iconic London taxis. Mm-hmm. But their plan, I mean, it's worth remembering that China overtook the US last year as the largest auto market in the world. Geely's plans for Volvo are to essentially establish a premium mark in China. They're going to manufacture in Beijing.
But it's interesting that they're getting into Europe by buying European brands. I mean, I had a look at some of the Geely models. They look very nice, you know, very smart cars. But we don't see a Geely car, you know, treading the streets of London, driving the streets of London, do we?
Not yet. I mean, I think that this is the point, that the Chinese market is so large that this has been about actually just fulfilling demand there. I mean, they're looking to build 300,000 cars in Beijing, which is as many cars as Volvo make at the moment.
So the China market is so large, we've got some way off worrying about how to export to Europe, because they've got to satisfy domestic demand.
I think so.
Looking elsewhere, US employment data is out this week. Do you think it'll be very significant?
Employment is what's known as a lag indicator, which means that it's something which tends to improve later in the economic cycle.
But that's the point, because there's lots of concern that even if the economy comes out of recession and starts to grow, this will be a jobless recovery.
Well, it's been a well-touted phrase, isn't it? Part of the problem, we've talked before about the weather. That affected the job market quite severely in January and February. A lot of this sort of seasonal, the kind of construction type of work, which just got pulled for a few months. But these figures, I mean, they're likely to show the unemployment rate in the US unchanged at about 9.7%. But it should at least show that the direction's a positive one.
Hey, Rob Benjamin, many thanks. Now, within the next hour or so, a court in China is expected to pass a verdict on four executives from the mining company Rio Tinto. They've been charged with taking bribes and stealing commercial secrets. The four include one Australian and three Chinese nationals. The case comes at a time of rising global trade tensions. It's also being widely viewed, I think, as a barometer of the way China treats foreign companies. John Mayer is a mining analyst. He's also managing director of the investment bank Fairfax. Good morning.
Good morning.
Much has been made about this case, raising broader issues about doing business in China. In your view, does it raise issues beyond the particulars of this case?
Yes, I think there are. I think foreign companies working in China are going to have to look very carefully at how the Chinese are reacting to, shall we say, price increases in China, the way business is generally being done, because this is not an isolated case. We're seeing a clampdown on corruption right across China. I think we've got a celebrated case on corruption with football referees going on. In fact, we saw the death sentence passed on somebody recently for in a corruption case. So this is very serious.
Is business corruption in China endemic?
I believe it is. We were surprised to see the corruptions or the bribery side of this. I think the Chinese were really very angry about not the stealing of state secrets, but the very clever industrial intelligence undergone by Rio Tinto over the years, which put them in a very commanding place regarding the supply of iron ore into China. And in fact, if anything, I think the Chinese should be very grateful that they went through that research process. Otherwise, the Chinese simply wouldn't be able to get the iron ore that they need.
I suppose around this case, there are hints of concern in the Western media. In particular, Chinese court cases aren't open to the public. Is there any concerns about cases like these not being conducted properly and fairly?
There's a great deal of political concern. Both the UK, I think the US, and even the Australian governments have expressed that there is a right for particularly their diplomats to be present at these trials, and that there is legislative process in place which should allow them to be at these trials.
You see, in particular, the arrests of these men happened a month after Rio walked away from a big deal with China's state-owned aluminium company. And there seemed to be some suggestion that the bringing of the case was somehow linked to this commercial deal. Do you think that sort of accusation has any basis at all?
Yes, I think the timing is very interesting, shall we say, and there's almost certainly some linkage. They could have looked at this over the last 5 or 10 years, and yet they didn't. They chose this time.
And yet, if China is cracking down on any alleged corruption, despite concerns, isn't that a good thing?
Well, we would say it's a good thing, certainly in this country, but there's so much of it in China. You have to say, why have they picked on this particular case at this point in time?
Okay, John Mayer from Fairfax, many thanks.
The Guardian reports that RAF jets have been scrambled twice this month in response to terrorist alerts on passenger airliners flying over Britain. According to defence sources, the most recent incident was last Monday, when British air traffic controllers picked up the words hostage and ransom from a United Airlines plane. Both cases turned out to be false alarms. 7:14. And the main headline this morning is that there have been two explosions on the underground network in Moscow. At least 25 people died in the first blast. The second is reported to have killed around 15. Prosecutors are treating the explosions as possible terrorism.
President Obama surprised everyone, including the president, by suddenly turning up in Afghanistan last night. Here's part of what he told an audience of American soldiers.
And we also salute the members of the Afghan National Army who are fighting alongside all of you. They're risking their lives to protect their country. And as I told President Karzai today, the United States is a partner, but our intent is to make sure that the Afghans have the capacity to provide for their own security. That is core to our mission, and we are proud of the work that they are doing and the continuing increased capacity that we're seeing out of Afghan National Security Forces. So thank you very much for the great work you're doing to take responsibility for security here in your own country.
Well, Martin Patience is our correspondent in Kabul. The president of Afghanistan might have been a little bit miffed, I suppose, at this short notice, Martin?
Well, we are hearing at this end that actually he did know 2 or 3 days ahead of this trip. But you're right in pointing out it was kept top secret. Certainly, President Karzai might have known some of his close officials, but certainly the wider country at large had no idea that President Obama was going to come to the country. This was his first trip since taking office almost 14 months ago. And I think many officials, particularly in the presidential palace, had wondered whether or not President Obama was going to come. There was a real sense that in many ways they'd been marginalised. There was testy relations between President Karzai and President Obama. And I think certainly Afghan officials here in Kabul will have welcomed this trip because it will be reaffirming what is a crucial relationship between President Obama and his Afghan counterpart, President Karzai.
So why was it not announced earlier? Just security?
I think, yeah, I mean, pretty much security. It was only 6 hours on the ground. It was all done under the cover of darkness. There have been attacks in Kabul, and I think that American officials were deeply, deeply worried that this trip could leak out in some fashion and there could have been an attack in Kabul. So certainly the main feeling was that this trip was kept top secret because of those security concerns.
And you say it was intended, or am I just inferring this from what you said, that President Obama is saying to Karzai, we are still with you?
Yes, I think in some ways, certainly in public, there was a warm spin on this trip. But behind closed doors, I think there would have been a very tough message delivered to President Karzai. President Obama wants the Afghan leader to do more. He wants him to tackle corruption within his administration, reform his governance. Because the feeling is that President Obama's poured in resources, doubled the number of troops in the country, and that if the US strategy is to succeed here, then the Afghan government must improve its performance in the coming months and years if there is to be success for the American campaign in Afghanistan.
Thanks, Martin.
Leominster 7, tens of thousands of American troops have been stationed in Japan for the past 60 years. But a new Japanese prime minister has come to power promising a more equal relationship with the US and has suspended an agreement to restructure American forces there. Plans to move Futenma Air Base to another site in Okinawa Island have provoked a very strong local reaction and have shaken the politics of Japan, whose defence minister meets the US defence secretary today. What is all the fuss about? From Japan, Alistair Leithhead reports.
Every day at 8 a.m. here on Okinawa Island, the Japanese and American flags are raised together.
Thank you.
Both anthems are played as the Stars and Stripes and the Rising Sun fly side by side. The two countries made a deal 60 years ago in the aftermath of war, but now there are rumblings over that agreement. There are nearly 50,000 US troops based in Japan and a lot of aircraft. For decades, America has provided Japan's defense in exchange for a strategic US base. Japan's even been described as America's unsinkable aircraft carrier. I'm walking through the Peace Park on Okinawa Island, a memorial to all those people who died during the Second World War. 12,500 American troops were killed here. On the Japanese side, it was nearer 200,000, with half of them being civilians. All their names are inscribed on granite slabs. The people of Okinawa suffered greatly during the Second World War, and today they say they're shouldering more than their share of the burden for hosting American forces. Three-quarters of the U.S. facilities in Japan are based on their island. But it's not just a local dispute. There's a new government in Japan promising change and a more equal relationship with the United States.
We also share the objective of a more equal alliance partnership. It's not an equal treaty.
Raymond Green is the U.S. Consul General in Okinawa, and he defends the U.S. presence.
I think it's an incredibly stabilizing factor. Asia is going through a period of historic strategic change in the balance of power. We have the missile and nuclear programs in North Korea. Obviously, the rise of China is something that we all welcome, but as it rises economically, there's also many questions about the military modernization program and the transparency, or lack thereof, that has gone along with that.
The voices of protest are being heard.
Okinawan people do not need American base.
It will destroy the environment for the future generation. So we should get together, I think, to let them leave.
The focus is plans for Futenma Air Base. The previous government agreed to relocate it to another part of Okinawa, but a new prime minister was elected promising to move it off the island. He's now caught between keeping his promise and a domestic political coalition together and managing relations with America.
All right, Marines, we have a felony traffic stop we're going to hit up right now.
A SWAT armed response team is training on a U.S. base.
Military police!
Practicing pulling a suspect from a car.
Hey, overall, I mean, that looks really good.
Assessing the exercise is Gunnery Sergeant Brian Dye. He's lived in Japan with his family for 3 years. Some locals say they're tired of the U.S. presence here. A high-profile rape case in 1995 tarnished their image, and the troops do bring some crime to the island. The curious sights and sounds of a St. Patrick's Day parade through the streets of Okinawa City. It's a strange blend of cultures. In many parts of this island, you could easily be in America. The relationship the two countries have is too important to collapse, but it will take careful political and diplomatic footing to stay on track.
Alistair Letha reporting from Japan. It is 7 minutes to seven. And just to update you on the main news this morning, which is that there have been two explosions on the Moscow Underground. They've killed, according to the authorities there, at least 34 people. 18 have been wounded. The prosecutors, Russian prosecutors, already saying that they suspect terrorists were responsible, and they've opened an investigation.
The Copenhagen talks on climate change didn't exactly deliver the goods. The next lot are going to be in Mexico, and they're about to announce plans for them. Our environment analyst is Roger Harribin. I suppose the first thing to ask you, Roger, is what's happened since Copenhagen, if anything?
Well, what's happened since is that countries have been urged to sign up to the Copenhagen Accord, which was the agreement drawn up by a small group of countries to be presented to the rest. And more than 100 countries have signed up to that, but there are still a significant number of holdouts. And I think the big question now is where do we go from here? Because the emissions cuts have been agreed. They may not get much better, I think, realistically. But there are some major bits of business to sort out, like $30 billion were agreed for fast finance for developing countries. to get clean energy and to adapt to climate change. We don't yet know how that is going to appear and how it's going to be distributed. That'll rise to 100 billion. It's important to get that sorted out. And also, the Copenhagen talks did actually move substantially closer towards a major deal to protect rainforests, which many people, including a lot of people skeptical about climate change, would be keen to see that deal. And so there's that to do as well. And also, the British government is very keen to see the deal made legally binding. And so talks will be going on through the year, ending in Mexico at the end of the year, to try to sort out some of that mess that's left behind.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? A new treaty is needed.
Well, the British government says a new treaty is needed, but other major players are very resistant to doing anything that would be legally binding. Some people think this is a bit of a moot point, John, because, you know, the last treaty, the Kyoto Protocol, is legally binding. Canada has way exceeded its targets and will not be punished. So some people ask, what's the point of a legally binding treaty when countries can't be bound? But it's something the British government and the European Union very strongly wants. And the big question, really, is for the poor Mexicans who have to try to sort out the mess from Copenhagen, about how you work out an international system like this, John, where you've got all countries involved, but it's impossible to negotiate targets and timetables and all that stuff with all the countries around a single table. And the Mexicans have got the job of sorting out this headache, and they're working with a number of ideas. I think we're going to see a much less ambitious timetable, but what they say is going to be a realistic one. And what they're hoping to do, I think, the initial soundings suggest they're going to try to separate off a couple of areas where they can get a definite win, like maybe on a forests agreement, maybe on the financing. But of course, then they'll reach the whole old problem of nothing is agreed till everything is agreed. So I think it would be too soon to be optimistic even about the relatively modest aims that are being achieved now.
And in the meantime, just in a nutshell, everybody says, oh no, how boring this is all becoming.
Well, I mean, it's hard work, John, and I was at a meeting last week where I heard somebody say that they had seen the really hard, tough people broken by the climate change negotiations in Copenhagen. Spirit sapped, utterly exhausted, sort of carted off.
Roger, many thanks.
Carted off.
We shall have the latest, of course, on the explosions on the Moscow Underground. It seems many people have been killed. And digital radio, do you want it? Are you right not to want it if you don't want it?
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with John Humphreys and Justin Webb. It's 7 o'clock on Monday, the 29th of March. The headlines this morning: two huge explosions have rocked the Moscow Underground. Up to 40 people have been killed and terrorism is being blamed. The Conservatives say they will not go ahead with a planned rise in national insurance for low and middle-income earners. And efforts to ban mephedrone could be delayed by the resignation of one of the government's drugs advisers. BBC News is read this morning by Neil Sleet.
Two explosions have ripped through the underground system in Moscow, killing about 40 people. The blasts happened during the morning rush hour. The Russian authorities are treating the explosions as a possible terrorist attack. Rupert Wingfield-Hayes reports from Moscow.
The first blast is reported to have gone off in the Lubyanka metro station at just before 8 o'clock in the morning. Police say there have been fatalities inside a train and on the station platform. At least 25 people are reported dead and dozens more injured. A second blast went off around 40 minutes later at the Park Kulturi metro station. So far, police there say between 10 and 15 people have been killed. Moscow authorities have already declared it a terrorist incident. No one has yet claimed responsibility, but the attacks do appear to have been coordinated and timed to cause the greatest number of casualties. Moscow's metro is the busiest in the world, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, it is jammed with hundreds of thousands of commuters.